Thank you very much, Peter. This, you've had a long day, haven't you? I'm going to begin our reflection this evening by reading this paragraph from the Decree on the Ministry and Life of Priests. By preserving virginity or celibacy for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, priests are consecrated in a new and excellent way to Christ. They more readily cling to Him with undivided heart and dedicate themselves more freely to Him and through Him to the service of God. They are less encumbered in their service of His kingdom and of the task of heavenly regeneration. By means of celibacy, priests profess their willingness to be dedicated with undivided loyalty to the task entrusted to them. They are made a living sign of that world to come, already present through faith and charity. Now that language is very beautiful, and it's very lofty. But somewhere along the line, it's important for every priest to personalize one's celibate choice. To be able to ask myself, not the church, no one else, no book, but to ask myself, why am I choosing celibacy? Why do I say that I have that gift to live the celibate life? If you read that talk that I gave at the synod, basically I said that the church is choosing her ministers at this time in history from those who say that they have that gift of celibacy. So I need to ask myself, what makes me say that I have the gift of celibacy? Why am I choosing celibacy? And then when I answer that question, I must remember that each one of us with this value, celibacy as value, as with every value, I need to appropriate this value with mind and heart to myself. I need to make it my own. So every day, every single day, I need to receive that gift. And every single day, I need to confirm this in my life. Now let me come up with an answer as to why am I choosing celibacy. And this is simply an answer for a working evening here tonight, for a working reflection. You could come up with other answers, and that would be all right. I choose celibacy because it allows me to meet the psychological and spiritual needs of myself and of others, those whom I am serving, and to feel close to God in ways which I could not do if I were married and not celibate. Let me give that again. I choose celibacy because it allows me to meet the psychological and spiritual needs of myself and of others, those whom I am serving, and to feel close to God in ways which I could not do if I were married and not celibate. So three elements must be included in that choice: that my psychological and spiritual needs are being taken care of, and even daily choosing Jesus Christ, and daily affirming celibacy for the sake of Jesus Christ, can be a tremendously deepening spiritual experience. Both needs being taken care of, and meeting these needs not only in myself but in others, those whom I am serving. And it allows me to feel close to God in ways I could not do if I were married or not celibate. Now, sometimes a person chooses celibacy, but his choice is vested with the motives of someone else. Sometimes that choice is vested with the reasons that the encyclical on celibacy might give, a magnificent encyclical. Or sometimes someone would choose celibacy because of the reasons from the decree on the church which I've just read. Or sometimes celibacy is chosen because some writer has written so beautifully about it. Those can be very beautiful and wonderful motives. They can be written in lofty language. But those motives are as good as I make them my own. They are as good as they are mine, and those motives in some way must become mine. Otherwise, that gift is not going to become part of my life, the way I live, the way I love, the way I relate to God, the way I relate to people. For instance, we could hear, you should be celibate for the sake of the kingdom. That's beautiful. We could hear, celibacy frees me from the responsibilities of secular or family life. Beautiful. Celibacy gives you a witness to the transcendency of the kingdom of God. Beautiful. But unless that becomes mine, unless in some way I have come to terms in my life that my celibacy is giving witness to the kingdom of God, unless I have come to terms with that, and all those other motives, then those motives can be over here and I can be over here. And if the two don't meet, there's a tremendous or an enormous clash that occurs in the life of any one person. It's like a man who might marry a girl, and the girl says, well, in order to marry you, my mother-in-law must come to live with us, or my mother must come to live with us. And the man doesn't get in touch with that, and the mother comes to live with them, and she's living there, and then all of a sudden, one morning, he wakes up, and he discovers her at the breakfast table, and he realizes this is going to be for the rest of her life. She's going to be sitting across from me when I have my second cup of coffee.
or even my first cup of coffee.
Now, unless somewhere along the line he dealt with that, that was like a rider to his marriage to that young woman. And now he wakes up and he doesn't like it. So in some way there must be that incorporation of that gift into our lives. We must come to terms in it. Otherwise, it can cause resentment, it can cause depression, and that's when we find the man railing from the altar, turning off the lights and all those other things because of that kind of resentment that comes up. There's an anger there because he has never dealt with this. Now, certainly, motives can change. One can re-choose celibacy at 42 or 52 or 62, and that's been done. But for our reflection tonight, it's helpful to understand the celibate paradox. And the celibate paradox is this, that the more mental health a man has, the more will celibacy be a challenge. And the less mental health a man has, the less will celibacy be a challenge. If a man has no or little problem with celibacy, that person is usually asexual or antisexual. So if a man is healthy, celibacy is going to cause some stress. And if you don't want the celibate stress, then do the following. Teach that man to be emotionally distant. Teach him to be aloof. Create in that man a negative attitude toward women. Teach him not to value human love or intimacy. Teach him a regressive or repressive theology that says that God loves celibate people more than non-celibate. And teach him that he can't do very well as a non-priest. Contrast that kind of priest with a mentally healthy priest. A mentally healthy priest loves his human sexuality. He is warm, he is alive. He has come to terms with where he is sexually, and he likes women, and he does not treat women as near occasions of sin. He values intimacy. He values friendship. He values sharing his life with others. He's autonomous, and he knows that he can leave the priesthood tomorrow and still do well. And the more healthy a person becomes, the more will celibacy become a problem. But if we want a healthy priesthood, then we permit the stress. The priest at times might be in anguish, but he will be a healthy priest. So let's look at some of the supports now that will help that priest through that stress, that healthy priest who has said, I have the gift of celibacy, who's looked at the church and understood that the church is choosing her ministers who profess this gift. Let's look at some of the supports that that priest will need in order to deal with that healthy stress. The first support. It's very, very important to have close priest friends. So important. I mentioned earlier today that this comes alive in Jesu Caritas groups. I mentioned that it can come alive with just good friends, knowing that they are with us, calling us to task when we need to be called to task. There is nothing in the world, in my estimation, quite as nurturing as a good friend. And let me say this, that in our diocese, where there had been so much pain, so much of that pain was caused by men who were loners. Loners. And when you have good friends that you can share with, then there's a tremendous good that can come out of that. I recall that when I was pastor in Albany, I had a wedding one day. It was on a Saturday, and the bride did not want to be married in the Roman Catholic Church. She wanted to be married in a neutral territory because she said her family would never be comfortable coming into a Roman Catholic church. So we went through all of the preparations and everything else, and I got permission to have that wedding in Union College Memorial Chapel. So the night of the rehearsal of Friday night, I went over there and I stood there, and up here in the sanctuary was the organist, and she was there for the rehearsal. So I said, I'll come out, I'll bow to you, bride and all your ladies, I'll bow to you, groom and groomsmen, I'll bow to you. And then you start to play, you start to come down the aisle, you come over to pick up the bride. Well, we went through that and it worked out beautifully, the rehearsal. And I went home that night thinking to myself, this is wonderful. I don't have anything tomorrow morning until noon. I can work around, I can read, I can have a great Saturday morning. It was the feast of Teresa of Avila, a beautiful October day. Well, I went out to get in my car at 11 o'clock to drive about 50 minutes to Union College Memorial Chapel. And as I looked down on the seat, I saw planning sheet. Time, 11 o'clock. And I thought, that can't be 11. That was 12 o'clock. It's not 11 o'clock. That wedding was at 12 o'clock. And I started to drive over. And I kept reciting that beautiful prayer of Teresa of Avila, let nothing affright thee, let nothing disturb thee. All things are passing, only God suffices. And the more I said it, the more my blood pressure went up. Well, I got into Schenectady, Union Street, Upper Union, going down toward Memorial Chapel, and they were having Old Town Week, a beautiful October day, and the merchants had dresses out, and kids were running across the street. I thought I would never get there. Finally, I got down to Union College Memorial Chapel at about 12 o'clock, and the groomsmen were all standing in the front, and they came running over to my car saying, what happened to you? What's the matter? What's the matter? I said, everybody get inside and I'll explain. Well, they led me back into the sacristy area where stood the bridesmaids crying. And I said, where's the bride? They said, she's in the bathroom. And then I said, what are you all doing here? They said, she started. I said, who started? They said, the organist started. The organist started at 11 o'clock, and you all came down the aisle? I said, "Where is the bride?" They said, "In the bathroom." So I went over to knock on the door. I said, she said, "Who is it?" I said, "Father Flynn." "I'll never come out," she said. I said, "You've got to come out." "I'll never come out." I said, "Then I have to come in." So I walked in and I faced the wrath. She turned on me. "Why did you do this to me?" I said, "Would you please come out? We have to go through this again." She said, "I'll never walk down that aisle again." And the groom-to-be said, "Honey, honey, please come down the aisle one more time. Please." I said, "Would you do it for him?" "No." I said, "Would you do it for me?" "Oh, well," finally we got her out. And I said, "Everybody, we've got to go out and do this." So I went out and I couldn't face that audience. I couldn't look at them. You know, I couldn't put my head up. That hostile audience. By this time, it's about 20 after 12, and they're all sitting there glaring at me. Well, I went like this to the thing. And then I went like this, and then I went like this. Well, she would come down three pews and stop and cry. And by this time, when she got up to me, she had the sympathy of everyone in that church, even if they had not been there for the wedding. She had the sympathy. I had none. So finally she got up and she was sobbing and crying. I said, "Would you please stop? Please stop crying so we can get through this wedding." Well, when I finished the wedding, I thought to myself, this was a terrible thing for me to do today. How did I do that? These people, they weren't comfortable with the church. Now they'll hate the church. They'll think priests don't care. How did I do it? So all day long, I went back to St. Ambrose. I had the afternoon masses, and it was bothering me, bothering me, bothering me. So that night, I called Father Dennis Brennan, a good friend of mine, born in Ireland, and I called him, and I went through this whole thing about how she came down, and she cried, and he cried, and they cried, and everybody cried, and looked angry, and I was sick, and he said, "You did that?" And I said, "Yes." And he started to laugh. He said, "This is the funniest thing I've ever heard." Well, all of a sudden, the cloud vanished. All of a sudden, the cloud vanished. That's what I mean. That's what I mean. Someone who can take away the pain. Who is it? So very important to have that kind of a priest friend or friends. The second support that I feel is absolutely essential in order to live celibacy is an hour of prayer every single day. An hour of prayer. And we hear all kinds of excuses for this. "I'm too busy, the phone, these duties." No one is too busy for an hour with God. We are living our lives in friendship with Jesus Christ. St. Mark tells us in very clear language, he called the 12 apostles and he wanted them to be with him and to preach. We shouldn't preach without prayer. We should not preach without spending time with Jesus Christ. And Andre Nouwen, I think in that book, which might be selling there, talks about those moments that we need most. We need to hear that beautiful expression, "You are my beloved." And Jesus Christ will speak that to you in prayer. And at times you don't want to pray. At times I don't want to pray. John of the Cross would go into prayer and he would spend the time in prayer and he would write in his notebook, "Nada, nothing, nothing." It was terrible. Teresa of Avila, when it would be time for her to pray, would go to the toward the oratory and try to find all kinds of excuses to go in another direction. But she went in, and both of them became the great mystics and taught others how to communicate with God. We need to pray. So if we're not convinced of this, if we are not convinced of at least an hour every day with Jesus Christ, I don't even have to go on with the rest, and the conference before was a waste of time. We need to have that time with Jesus Christ. It's the most beautiful time that we can experience. It's the time when we are chastised, when Jesus Christ tells us, this is where you're going off. You're kidding yourself. You're walking down a path here, and you're going to end up destroying yourself and destroying others. And it's the time when we are consoled, when Jesus Christ is able to say to us, you are my beloved as I am the beloved of the Father. And I've asked the Father to love you as much as the Father loves me. And you're not alone. You are not alone. And I'm with you. And I'll uphold you, and I'll walk with you, and I'll sustain you. And don't you worry. Everything's going to be all right. But you need an hour. Don't tell me you're too busy. You're not as busy as I am, I bet. And I wouldn't think of a day without an hour with God. At least an hour with God. It's absolutely essential. And fight for it. Because everyone around you, even friends and staff, would try to take that hour away. And what could be more beautiful within any parish if when people came looking for you, the secretary or the housekeeper would be able to say, you can't disturb him now, he's at prayer. He's at prayer. What a comfort for a parish. Just like Jesus Christ, everybody is looking for you. So what? Steal off to be with the Father and enjoy the Father's love. We can't talk about celibacy unless we're talking about this struggle. And I call it a struggle. I call it wrestling with prayer. Because just as John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, just as though you have to fight for it, and when you get in there, your mind goes in 1,000 different directions. But then, one moment, everything will be quiet. And God speaks. And then we know what John of the Cross said when he said so beautifully that God has said only one word. He has spoken only one word. And he speaks that word in eternal silence. And it is in eternal silence in which it makes itself heard. There is nothing like that. And then we have the courage to go out and face it. The third support. Spiritual director who is seen at least once a month. And this keeps people aware. And you can call this spiritual friend, soul friend, you can call him or her whatever you want. But there's nothing quite like it. When you're able to go to a person and that person can know you better than anyone else, and that person can be a good friend, or that person can be another person whom you see, with whom you can be very honest, and you're able to say, this is what is happening in my life. And the other person is able to say, is that what you want to happen? Is this the way you want to go? But basic honesty. Here I am. And the fourth, a certain job satisfaction. Now, I don't mean those days or times of difficulty that we have with all of our jobs. I said to our newly ordained when I was ordaining them in that instruction that I give, I said, don't be getting up on a Sunday morning and telling the people how stressed out you are. They're stressed out. They come for the Word of God. And then sometimes they get into a parish and hear the guy going on, "Oh, I had a terrible, terrible week." Suppose you had all those children to get ready. That would be a terrible, terrible morning, and then bring them all to church. Don't be telling them how stressed out you are. They're stressed out. I'm not talking about those normal stresses. I'm talking about the situations where you have a square peg in a round hole. Do you know what I mean? There are some people who are never, never, never could grow working in an office, all day long in an office, without seeing people. And there are others who might thrive on that. Well, if you put someone who should never be in an office, well, then you're asking for difficulty. Or if you put someone who would be delighted to work in an office and put him with all kinds of people, then you're asking for some difficulty. There should be some kind of manageable job satisfaction whereby we're not just running away from every difficult situation we can find or that happens to come up. But when the difficult situation becomes a way of life or a minor theme, we're willing to go to a bishop and talk about it, and that bishop is willing to listen. So there should be basic job satisfaction. The fifth support, a self-discipline. I don't like doing this, but it is good to do. Running or walking. Sometimes a person might not like running. Sometimes a person might not like to get on one of those machines that go nowhere. I hate them. And you stand there and read and you think, if I were found dead on this, they'd think I'd lost my mind. Just standing there, it's going nowhere. But it's good. It's good. Or doing those things that we don't want to do, but we know they're good for us. At certain times of the year, certain seasons of the church, disciplining ourselves, not taking every drink that comes down the pipe, not taking everything to eat that is offered, and especially when we would like it. Disciplining ourselves, but that doesn't mean we can't go out to a good place once in a while and have a good meal. But you know what I mean. Being able to say, I'm going to say no to myself now. I don't want to, but it's good. To be conscious of that. And the sixth one, have many lay friends. I once heard a psychologist say, and he said very well and very truthfully, married people have the vow of celibacy with one exception. Married people have the vow of celibacy with one exception. And if you don't have many friends, you save up all that love and it goes sometimes in the wrong direction. Jesus Christ should be our primary basic love. And if Jesus Christ is our primary basic love, if we are relating to him and talking to him and listening to him, then all other loves become fuller and richer. And then in loving Christ more, we are loving them even more. But to be able to look and have as friends a married couple who are living out their vows so beautifully, how enriching that is for the priest. And then finally, a sensitive diocesan administration. I'll repeat that. Seems as though some might not have heard that. A sensitive diocesan administration. In other words, a chancery needs to be sensitive to the needs of our priests. And a chancery, a bishop and his staff are human indeed, but the priests are so important, so important. Where could the church go without the priest? Where? We wouldn't have our Lord in the Eucharist, and we need to take care of our priests. So then, we have the psychological health of priests about which I spoke this afternoon, interacting with another circle, the support system of which I spoke here, and then interacting with the stress of celibacy. And out of that should come a healthy priest. So what I'm saying here is that if one is living the celibate life, one should not feel as though there's going to be no stress. There's going to be stress, just as there's stress for that man who's married in a happy marriage, and then he's in an office, and all of a sudden meets someone else who has just lost her husband and needs a little sympathy, and he starts giving her too much sympathy on the wrong day, and all of a sudden spending less time with his wife, less time in prayer, less time attending to his duties, and everything gets off kilter. He could very well have given that kind of support to that young lady whose husband walked out on her without damaging and jeopardizing his own marriage if he kept everything else in perspective. If he were honest with his wife, spending the time with her, having prayer, relationship with God, honesty with a spiritual director, all the rest. Might there be a little stress? Yes. But still he would be living that life, that full life of marriage. And so it's the same with us. We cannot expect to be free from stress, and especially in a society which scoffs at chastity. It scoffs at chastity. Every time I confirm our young people, I challenge them to live chastely. And I also tell them that every evening on primetime television, from the Golden Girls to Cheers, the message is given that any kind of sex, no matter what it is, no matter how it comes through, is perfectly all right as long as it feels good. And then I remind them that it is God who has given this gift. It is God who has given this gift. And so there will be a stress in a society that is not comfortable with chastity. Now, let me speak in this section on some poor reasons for leaving a celibate commitment. Sometimes a man decides to leave a celibate commitment and he says, I'm going to leave because I'm lonely. So I think I should leave and get married. Does that mean that people who are married never get lonely? Not at all. There are times in every marriage when one or both might be experiencing loneliness. Loneliness can be at times a personality problem. Loneliness at other times just enters into our lives and we don't know why we're lonely. I think that this is a subject which can be looked at spiritually and psychologically, and it's a subject which could take much, much study. But there's something within the human heart that is not satisfied, and I think it is because we cannot have God to the fullest extent that we would want him as we would be journeying across this life. So this reflects itself, this desire for God, who, as Augustine says, is the only one who will ever satisfy all of our needs. This desire for God at times brings forth this loneliness. But if loneliness is a theme in our lives, if it becomes a minor theme, then it should be looked at. But we should be aware at the same time that sexual expression or intimacy do not always solve loneliness problems. Priests should find out, why am I lonely? Sometimes a person or a priest says, I'm leaving a celibate commitment because I'm experiencing depression. He needs to find out why he's experiencing depression. If he leaves and gets married, then we're going to have two people who are depressed. Sometimes depression comes from not having needs met. And it would be a very wise thing for that fellow to look back on the needs about which we spoke earlier. Are these being met? A person should not leave a celibate commitment if he has a drinking problem. He should solve that first and find out why he's having a drinking problem. And then sometimes a person will say that he is in love. Being in love doesn't mean that he should get married. Have you ever had two people standing in front of you, one of whom saying, I don't love her? Has that ever happened? It has? You're the first one to tell me that. he said, I don't love her? They were getting married? Oh, sorry. You were throwing my theory right out the window. Anytime two people get married, they always say, I'm in love. And yet, on so many occasions, they shouldn't get married. And so many marriages end in divorce, and all started out by saying, we are in love. And then sometimes there are serious second thoughts about celibacy commitments. In any commitment, there will be serious second thoughts. Married men and married women have serious second thoughts about their marriage and about that commitment. That doesn't mean they should walk out on it. Sexual thoughts are no reason to leave the celibate commitment. Masturbation is no reason to leave that sexual or that commitment of celibacy. And at the same time, masturbation is not something that one would want to live with forever. It's something that needs to be looked at and something from which one would grow to full freedom. But it is no reason to leave that celibate commitment. Now, what would happen, I would like to speak for a few moments on the psychological ramifications of a continuous non-celibate behavior in the priesthood. So what we're talking about here is non-celibate, interpersonal between two people, genital behavior in an ongoing way. Non-celibate, interpersonal, genital, in an ongoing way. What can we say about that? That can really create a problem. Because that is basically dishonest. The priest is saying one thing and he's doing another. And if that priest has an ordinary conscience, he will feel guilty. And if he feels guilty, then he'll begin to rationalize and repress. He'll have an unconscious guilt, and it will be there. And that's when we have that unconscious guilt showing itself in so many different ways, scolding people, yelling at people. All those different ways that come out of a repression of guilt. And that's when he starts doing destructive things and stupid things. simply because he's professing one thing and living another way. And if he has a weak conscience or a sociopathic personality, nothing will happen to him. He'll just go on like that for years, living one way, professing another, but living quite another from his profession. Living non-celibately and yet professing celibacy. And he'd go on like that, perfectly contented. And nothing will happen. He doesn't have to repress it or anything else because he has that sociopathic personality that's very comfortable doing that. Do one thing or the other. It's very important for yourself, and it's very important for the other person. It's important for a priest who has a relationship of this kind to ask himself, how fair is it for this woman in waiting? And sometimes a woman will say, don't leave the priesthood for me. It's perfectly all right to go on like this. However, she is waiting for that priest to leave. She doesn't date. She's burning her bridges. And there's a moral issue at stake here, which has nothing to do with celibacy. It has something to do with honesty. If I say to a woman, we're going to continue like this, that you're not going to date and you're burning your bridges, that is a moral issue that has something to do with honesty. The celibacy issue is another issue. It's a very real issue. But the honesty issue is very real, too. And again, sometimes it takes 3 years to build up someone like this with therapy once a week for someone who has waited for a priest to leave, and then he left her. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that one continues. And finally, you don't have to be caught in the broken leg syndrome. If any priest has had a non-celibate sexual relationship, he doesn't have to feel that he's a second-class citizen. We are the church. Remember that. And Jesus Christ came to call the sinners, to call the broken. That's why he came. And if he didn't come for this, the church would be empty. We're a church of saints, but we're a church filled with sinners, and a church of men and women who are struggling to do the best that they can. So anyone who has had a non-celibate sexual relationship, he doesn't have to feel that he's a second-class citizen. Many times a person with a broken leg can strengthen that leg, and that leg can become better than the one that was never broken. Anyone can make mistakes, anyone. And yet these mistakes can give us character. There are three things that I would recommend to you. Two books and one article. Celibacy, prayer, and friendship. Celibacy, prayer, and friendship by Kiesling, Kiesling, a Dominican, 1980, Alba House. Then from the journal Human Development, 1980, Celibate Anxiety by Jim Gill. Celibate Anxiety, in which he talks about that stress. And then Keith Clark, An Experience of Celibacy. So finally, let's go back to the beginning, and then I hope you'll reread what was in your packet It's a way of loving. But it's very, very important for me to personalize my celibate choice. Why am I living celibately? To make the reasons my own. No one else's, my own. And to integrate these reasons into my life, into the way I live, and into the way I love. Thank you. I could have drawn those three circles for you, but I wouldn't have had to play. But you got the idea anyway. Now, I know that you've had a lengthy day, but would anyone have any comments or anything to share that might be helpful? There had been a couple of people who had mentioned something to me earlier and asked if I would bring it up, and I haven't forgotten that. Yes, John.
Bishop, we're all well aware of the pedophilia cases and those lawsuits, but I think we should also be aware that there are many lawsuits about heterosexual activity with consenting adult-type behavior. And while if we have fallen in this way, we should, of course, confess, repent, and move on, as you're encouraging, I think it would help us all to be aware that the bishops, if I understand correctly, the bishops are also dealing with those kind of cases.
Absolutely. I did not mention that in this, but it's very true that if a man is a priest and he has a sexual relationship with an adult, that the sympathy of lawyers and the sympathy of the courts will go to that adult in the litigation and in making payment, because they say that this man evoked trust from this person, and as a result of that, violated that trust. And I've had some of those cases, and that's absolutely true, and something that we have to be very careful about. It's a double standard at the same time, because many times these people met outside of a counseling or professional relationship, and as a result of that, or they might have had a professional relationship, then years later met up with one another again. But the one who is going after the jugular vein says, well, I trusted him, he was a priest. And so now I'd like $50,000, $100,000. Very good point. That is an aspect of all of this which is very real, unfortunately. But even in that, We always need to keep going back to the human being. If in that a priest is a man, he's a human being, and this is always very tremendously complex. And sometimes facing that kind of possibility might push us to forget the heavenly dimension of it. That God is in all this, and out of this will come something great for the church and for the priesthood, and that we need to look at it with the eyes of God and the heart of God. Thank you, John.
Bishop, I usually don't like if questions, but if the church in the future does decide to allow married priests, what would that do to your definition of celibacy that you offered for us, or the value of celibacy? And what about any argumentation you may get about the early church? The apostles were married. Our Protestant brethren are married and live effective ministering lives.
Very good. I wouldn't be able to speculate as much on either of those, because what I'm... In making that proposal tonight, I was simply saying that the church at this point in history chooses her ministers from those who have that vow or that charism of celibacy, so that the person who is coming along in the seminary, the person who has been ordained, needs to appropriate that to himself. What happened earlier or what happened later, I do not know. But I do know that now, since the church is saying so very clearly, these are the ones, and not everyone has that gift. I cannot say you are going to have that gift, just as I cannot say you have to have the gift to take the vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience. That's a gift. It's a charism. But then when you say you have that gift, then in some way I'll be able to structure you so that you can make that vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience. But at this point in our history, the church is saying we are choosing our ministers from these who say they have that gift. My intention would be to encourage everyone to look at the gift and to appropriate that even more deeply to himself. And I think in the early church, too, the person was feeling very close to God. We can look at people in marriage who are tremendously close to God, living wonderful lives, and yet living it out in marriage. But I keep going back to that because I think it's a fine distinction. Where is the church calling her ministers from? From those who say, I have that gift. Here is a Jesuit father from Peru.
You came across to me as very convinced of the value of the talk of that Jewish doctor to the Dr. Berlin or whoever it was, and you so moved me by your conviction in communicating that to us. I wonder if you might say a few more points of what was his talk about.
You mean Dr. Berlin?
The bishop's meeting.
Oh, yes.
You said it was really a valuable thing.
Well, he came through very beautifully in that he wanted to encourage the bishops to take care of any victim, naturally, but also to be conscious of the perpetrator or the victimizer, and to remember that this is an illness, and as best possible to be able to work with that person through that, and also stated that there are times when a person can never minister again because of the depth of that illness, but many times a person can under certain circumstances. It was a tremendously balanced approach. Also, the doctor from St. Luke's Institute was very balanced also, because I think there has been a tendency of running scared, and if anyone had done anything of such a thing, yet this person should never minister anything. Absolutely. Well, these men were not saying, we're simply saying, look at it, look at all the aspects of it, and remember your church. So that would not come up with an answer for every case, but rather with certain principles behind us. Now, we have one priest, someone had asked me, who's been in prison for some time, and it will be for a lengthy period of time. And probably because of the notoriety, might be very, very difficult for a person like that ever to minister again, because of the tremendous notoriety. But that was the gist of it. There is another excellent article that was written in America Magazine in May by Canis Connors, who encourages the church to keep on going and looks at this whole thing from the viewpoint of a professional doctor who has been working with cases and priests and others too, victims, and encourages the church to keep going in the direction that we've been going and looking at this very honestly. But that pretty much was the theme of that day. And then also in the afternoon, the encouragement for reconciliation. Reconciliation is a very, very important part of that. There's no more important appointment that a bishop should have than with someone who's been hurt like that. It's very important to be able to listen. 2 weeks ago in my office, there was a man and woman, and she had been hurt very badly. We went through the whole thing and been dealt with before legally and all the other ways. So finally, after listening and listening and listening, going through this whole pain, it was all gone through before, but we were going through it again. And finally I said, I just want to say one thing to you. In the name of the church, in the name of any bishop, in the name of any priest who hurt you, in their names, in the name of that bishop, in the name of the priest, in the name of the church, I ask your forgiveness. Will you forgive? She started to cry, and she said, that's the first time that anyone has asked me for forgiveness. God is alive in even in this pain. And something healing would come forth from that. But we have to be able to say it. We're wrong. Someone made a mistake. Doesn't mean the person is wrong or anything or bad. Simply a mistake. We're a journeying to God. And in that journey, some days we see things very clearly. Others we do not. There are periods of time we do not see things clearly. And then all of a sudden, a new generation, a new century, we see something very clearly. This is a sickness. This is the way this should be handled. That's the way that should be handled. And that's the journey to God. Okay, Father? Okay. Well, there's one.
Bishop, at the table talking to other priests, we were wondering if only a few dioceses and a few bishops have had this problem, or many dioceses.
I don't think it is as extensive as the media would have us believe. When you consider the number, the vast number of priests working in the United States, there is a certain percentage right across the board in the segment of every society, of all of our society, which has experienced this problem. But it's only a very small percentage, and I think this has been pointed out over and over and over, and that's reflective of the society in which we live. For instance, in a society, there are many who suffer from the disease of alcoholism, and that's a disease. But that's a part of our society, isn't it? That's part of our cultures. So many suffer with heart attacks. So many suffer with cancer. So many suffer with brain tumors or whatever. These are all illnesses. So many suffer with fears, of phobias of all kinds. That's part of it. Doesn't mean that everyone, nor would that be true in the church. There's a certain reflection of the total number of ministers in the church who would be suffering from this, but not the vast numbers that the media at times would have us believe, because they just blow something up and it's the only thing. When you think of the numbers who are out there ministering and doing so beautifully, but at the same time are in pain because this would happen to a brother. Did that answer your question, Father? Not exactly. I don't know the numbers. I don't know the numbers, but it would be reflective in the church in the United States, just as it would be reflected in families in the United States, in schools, in through many adults who were not ministers who would be under that burden. Okay, Father.
Bishop, a few years ago, National Catholic Reporter ran a series of articles on priests who were living a active homosexual lifestyle and combining this with priesthood and thinking evidently perfectly okay. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes, I think that we have suffered in some ways from a culture that has said to us in many ways, live in any fashion that you want to. Live out sexually any way that you want. That is the message in our culture. It has been for the past 10 years, 15 years, whenever the sexual revolution began. Just live it out, have a good time. Now, when we are living in that kind of culture, we are bound to be affected by it in some ways. And that's why I think it's very important for priests to come together and speak about the beauty of chastity. Speak about the necessity to be with God. Speak about the evil of living two double lives, two types of lives. That is dishonest. And yet at times we can meet someone and say, it's perfectly all right. I'm praying and I'm one with God and I'm one with the world and I'm living this kind of way. That's an absurdity. That is an absurdity. You don't deal with God that way. God has his ways of calling us to freedom. God has his ways of calling us to grace. And living out that way, sexually active and at the same time with a vow and saying the vow is only not to get married, not to have any, that's crazy. I mean, any a child in second grade can figure that whole thing out. But we can keep telling ourselves that, and then you can't do that well, as I said here, if you have a normal conscience. You're going to repress that. It's going to come out in another way. And if you're sociopathic, have a sociopathic personality, you can do that for years and nothing will happen. But I think that we have been living in a culture which has said that to us. And so there's going to be some effect in that culture. And that's why a gathering such as this for all these weeks of these tremendous priests talking about things and being reminded is a tremendous grace for the church in the United States. And that's why this man, Andy Cusack, had this vision to bring these people together and to hear some things that would challenge us. And someone might be sitting there and say, well, I didn't do so well this way or that way. That's all right. This is the time now to turn. There's always that new tomorrow, that new beginning. But that's the reason for this. I was just at Steubenville a few weeks ago, and I was under that tent that first night. I'd never been. I'm not charismatic. I'm Irish. My African-American brothers over here will appreciate this. I am bishop in our diocese of the largest black Catholic parish in these United States, Holy Ghost in Opelousas. Well, when I first went there, I was only there about 2 months, I guess, and I went to this parish on a Sunday morning. Well, at the Our Father, I closed my eyes, and everyone in the church joined hands. I closed my eyes, and when I was awake, I opened my eyes, and they were all going back and forth with the music. I thought I was having a spell. I was in Los Angeles. And I couldn't get up. So then I tried it, and everyone was clapping. When I would clap, I'd be offbeat, and all the little kids would be laughing at me. So I explained, I said, I'm Irish. I don't think I'm going to be able to clap. But at any rate, what was I talking about? Oh, charismatic. Charismatic. I'm not charismatic, I'm Irish. But they invited me to the tent, and I went into the tent. And all these priests, there were about 400 priests there that night, praising God and speaking to God. Now, I don't understand fully yet the speaking in tongues. And now try to pray at that time. It's a beautiful thing, though. It's beautiful, powerful. And then all of those men went outside and went to confession afterwards. That's powerful. That's powerful for the church. And when they were singing, they're raising the roof off that tent, something wonderful is happening from that in the church in the United States. Marvelous things will happen from this, just from talking about things and renewing our commitment to a God who loves us very much. Sometimes we sell ourselves short. We say, I can't do this, I can't do that. No, we go more deeply into the mystery of God and see where He brings us.
Personal experience for me is probably the most significant element that helps me determine the credibility of what I hear, of what I see, those kinds of things. A lot of what I heard you say really strikes with my personal experience, and my experience confirms a lot of what you've said this afternoon and this evening. But that same personal experience also struggled with some of the things that you wrote and said, and by way of observation, if I can share with you some of those observations and invite whatever response you may wish to offer. First, if you'd let me just quote very briefly from the address that you had made to the Synod 2 years ago that was left in our packets. Celibacy and priesthood are two distinct, though related, vocations. Those who feel that God is calling them to priesthood must also detect a call to celibacy. And a bit further along, you say, the candidate who desires to be a priest but does not have the call to celibacy does not in the present discipline have a call to priesthood. That's where I struggle. That's where my personal experience struggles. As I look back on where I first experienced what I thought to be a call to priesthood and worked that through with various people in the church, etc., and came to the point 12 years ago of being ordained and serving as a priest, I look back on that, and what I experienced back there was a call to priesthood. There's no question in my mind and heart about that. A call that's been confirmed in countless ways in the 12 years since I've been ordained. But I can't honestly say in any way, shape, or form that I ever experienced a call in that same sense to a celibate lifestyle. What I did come to acknowledge and realize and struggle with during this time of discernment over a priestly vocation was the recognition that at this point in time, the church requires the condition of a celibate lifestyle to be a priest, and I had to deal with that. And I came to the point where, in your own words, I was able to accept and to make a free and full commitment to a life of celibacy. Now, for the sake of argument, if the church had given me the choice to make that full and free commitment or to not make that full and free commitment, I don't think I would have chosen to make that full and free commitment to celibacy. So in that sense, I struggle with your contention that the church does not impose celibacy on priests. In one sense, it does. But ultimately, I had to come to the point of personally integrating, and in a healthy way, and I feel I have, integrated the commitment, and with the information and what you shared with us today, as my experience confirms, the need to nurture and sustain that commitment.
Thank you, Father. I think the background of what I was saying there was the background of a rector in a seminary, having reminded young men for many years that the church calls. There are loads of people who might feel called to the priesthood, and that's all right, but it is the church that ratifies or validates that call. And the church validates that call through the call of the bishop. That's the way the church validates that call. So there can be loads of people who might say, I have a call to the priesthood, and we would know for the good of the church, that person should never be a priest. So the background of that was that reality, that it is the church that validates the call, and that it is the church that is saying this, we are calling now from those who say they have this charism. Now, I say that with an understanding that it's very possible that when you went through the seminary, that was not addressed. I can remember a very sad day in an airport on the eastern coast when I met a rector of a seminary, and he said to me, do you ever speak about celibacy? And these men whom I had in the seminary will know that on the Thursday night conferences, this was spoken of on many occasions. As I go back over those conferences, I would redo them now. But nevertheless, we jumped into it and we discussed it. And I said, yes. He said, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Now that's sad. That is very sad, because that meant that that generation never really looked at this under his auspices or under his leadership. Maybe they did with spiritual directors, I hope so. Maybe not. But that should have been clearly thought out, should have been. And if it wasn't, well then now again, in this particular time, we're looking at this and looking at it the best way that we can in trying to look at this whole thing through history. But it is a charism, and no charism can be imposed. The charism is a gift from God. But the church is saying, if you have that gift, then we will validate the call, because it is the church who validates the call. So that is about the extent of my ability to expound on that, but that would be the background for it. Thank you, Father.